Beams splashed jerkily across the curve of the unlit street and a ravaged concrete structure that looked as if it might once have been the back end of an arena. Dead street lamps stood at intervals, most of them remarkably intact and upright.
"For Christ's sake, Carla, this is the zones. Do you really want to have to stop and change a flat tire around here?"
She shrugged.
"You've got a gun. I'm sure you can cripple anyone who gives us a hard time."
"Oh, for fuck's sake." They left the curving street and swung left past decayed low-rise housing and steel-shuttered frontages. The usual graffiti leered from the walls, incoherent tribal rage and abstract flashing that looked like stretched purple and white skulls. Carla stared ahead, tight-lipped. Chris felt his post-fight mellowness charring at the edges.
"Hey, perhaps you'd rather he'd beaten her to death while we all sat there and listened to it. Good training for my future in the Ombudsman. Observe, take notes, and never, never fucking intervene in anything."
No response.
"Your father lives next door to that every fucking day of his life, Carla, and he does nothing, worse than nothing. He just shakes his fucking head and writes his agonized social commentary and feeds it to people who'll never know the realities of the situations he describes, and they all shake their head and do nothing. And next door, a thug goes on beating his wife to pulp."
"My father's a man in his 60s. Did you see the size of that piece of shit?"
"Yeah. That's why I shot him."
"That's no solution."
"I don't know. It seemed to slow him down."
"And what about when he recovers, Chris? When he's back on his feet and twice as angry as he ever was?"
"You're saying I should have killed him?"
"This isn't fucking funny."
Chris twisted around to face her.
"No, you're right, Carla. It isn't. It's sick. You're trying to get me, out of some twisted sense of moral outrage, to quit my job at Shawn and go work for men like Vasvik. And you saw how concerned he was back there. What a moral stand the fucking Ombudsmen are prepared to take in the face of injustice."
"He wasn't there for that, Chris."
"Neither was I, Carla. But I did something about it. Just like I'm going to do something in the name."
"Jesus! You think you can go through this life with your pristine ideals, taking notes and trusting some fuckwit UN judge to make everyone play nice? You think—"
The Land Rover leaned abruptly on its suspension. The road swung away in the high beams, replaced by the cross-hatching of an empty parking area. An abandoned supermarket loomed up ahead, facades smashed in and boarded up in about equal measures. There seemed to be a white, tubular metal reindeer riveted to the roof, face turned blankly to greet the shoppers from their cars. Vague, tangled debris that had once presumably been a sleigh trailed from the animal's rear and spilled down the roof as far as the sagging gutters. For one bizarre moment, the image reversed for Chris, and he saw an amorphous, tentacled creature dragging the reindeer down to its death. Carla braked them to a halt in the middle of the parking lot. For a moment they both sat staring out at the mall front. Then she turned to look at him.
"What's happened to you, Chris?" she whispered.
"Oh, Christ, Carla."
"I—"
she gestured convulsively.
"I don't recognize you anymore. I don't know who you are anymore. Who the fuck are you, Chris?"
"Don't be stupid."
"No, I mean it. You're angry all the time, furious all the time, and now you carry that gun around with you. When you started at Shawn, you told me about the guns, and you laughed about it. Do you remember that? You made fun of it. You made fun of the whole place, just like you used to at HM. Now you barely laugh at anything. I don't know how to talk to you anymore. I'm scared you're going to just snap and start yelling at me."
"Keep on like this," he said grimly, "and guess what? I'll probably snap and start yelling at you. And no doubt it'll be my fucking fault again."
She flinched.
"You want to know who I am, Carla?"
He was leaning across the Land Rover, toward her, in her face.
"You really want to know? I'm your fucking meal ticket, just like I always have been. Need new clothes? Need tickets to Norway? Need a handout for Daddy? Need to move out of the city and live somewhere nicer? Hey, that's okay. Chris has got a good job. He'll pay for it all. He doesn't ask much, just keep the car clean and the odd blow job. It's a fucking bargain, girl."
The words seemed to do something coming out. He felt tearing, somewhere indefinable. He felt dizzy, suddenly weak in the numb quiet that swallowed up what he'd said. He propped himself back away from her and sat, waiting, not sure what for. The silence hummed.
"Get out," she said.
She hadn't raised her voice. She didn't look at him. She hit the central locking console and his door cracked open.
"You'd better be sure about..."
"I warned you before, Chris. You called me a whore once. You don't get to do it twice. Get out."
He looked out at the deserted parking area, the darkness beyond the Land Rover's lights. He smiled thinly.
"Sure," he said. "Why not? Been coming to this for long enough."
He shouldered the door fully open and jumped down. The night air was warm and comfortable, edged with a slight breeze. It was easy enough to forget where you were. He checked he still had the Nemex in its holster, his wallet in the jacket pocket, still thick with cash.
"See you then, Carla."
Her head jerked around suddenly. He met her eyes, saw what was in them, and ignored it.
"I'll be at the office. Call me if the bills need paying, huh?"
"Chris."
He slammed the door on it. He strode away without looking back, aiming only to get beyond easy hailing distance. Behind him, he heard the Land Rover put in gear and moving. He wondered briefly if she'd come after him at curb-crawl speed across the parking lot, and what, in that ridiculous scenario, he would do. Then the high beams washed once over him, and fled left away through the white-box sprawl of the parking area. The engine lifted through the gears as she picked up speed. He felt a single stab of worry, that she might not be safe getting home on her own. He grimaced, and slammed a door on that as well. Then she was gone. He turned, finally, to look, and was in time to catch the taillights of the Land Rover disappearing amid the low-rise huddle of housing on the other side of the lot. A few moments later, the engine noise faded into the vehicle-free stillness of night in the zones. He stood for a while, trying to get his bearings, geographic and emotional, but it was all utterly unfamiliar. There was nothing recognizable on the skyline in any direction. The supermarket faced him with its wrecked frontages, and he felt a sudden, insane desire to lever loose some of the boarding, use the butt of the Nemex to do it, and slip inside, looking for... He shivered. The dream marched through his head in neon-lit pulses. Sudden, warm rain of blood. Falling. He shook his head hard, turned his back on the facade, then he picked an angle across the parking lot at random and started walking. Up on the roof, the tube metal reindeer watched him through eyes empty of anything except the cool evening wind. Saturday night, Sunday morning. The cordon zones. He'd expected trouble, had even, with some of the same twisted joy that had driven his actions at the Brundtland, been looking forward to it. The Nemex was a grab away beneath his jacket. His hands were Shotokan toughened and itchy with a desire to do damage. Worst-case scenario, his mobile would get him a police escort out, should he really need it. Rather coldly, he knew he'd have to be literally fighting for his life before he'd make that call. Anything less, he'd never live it down. He'd expected trouble, but there was nothing worthy of the name. He walked for a while through anonymous, poorly lit estates, emerging once or twice onto main thoroughfares to take his bearings from scarred and vandalized road signs, and then plunging back in, heading what he estimated was east. TV light flickered and glowed in windows. Game show noise escaped through the cheap glazing. Occasionally figures moved within. Outside he saw children perched on walls in the gloom, sharing cigarettes, 2-liter plastic bottles and crudely homemade solvent pipes. The first set he ran across spotted the clothes and came jeering toward him. He drew the Nemex and met their eyes, and they backed off, muttering. He kept the gun where it could be seen after that, and the other groups just watched him pass with bleak calculation. Whispered invective slithered in his wake.
Eventually he came out onto a main road that looked as if it might run due east. Between the buildings on his left he thought he could make out the vaulted march of the M40 Inrun converging from the north, which suggested he was somewhere near Ealing. Or Greenford, if he'd miscalculated how far out Carla had dumped him. Or Alperton. Or you're lost, Chris. Fuck it. You don't really know this part of town, so stop pretending you do. Just keep moving. Pretty soon the sun's got to come up, and then you'll damn well know if you're heading east or not. Keep moving. It had to be better than thinking. He started to see signs of nightlife. Clubs and arcades at intervals along the street in various stages of turnout. Junk food takeouts, most of them little more than white neon blasted alcoves in the brickwork. The low-intensity stink of cheap meat and stale alcohol, laced once or twice with acid spikes of vomit. Little knots of people in the street, eating and drinking, shouting at each other, turning to stare at him as he passed. It couldn't be helped. He lengthened his stride, kept the Nemex lowered but clearly in view, kept to the center of the street. In theory, he could have tried to call a cab. He had landmarks now, identifiable club frontages, and, if he was prepared to look hard enough in the gloom, street name plaques. In practice, it was probably a waste of time. The companies his mobile knew numbers for mostly wouldn't come more than a few hundred meters the wrong side of the cordons, especially at this time of night. And those few that would tended to follow an esoteric driver's mythology on exactly which streets were safe to pick up from. Get the wrong configuration in this tarot of zone codes, and you could wait all night. Hearing a location they didn't like, better yet hearing some idiot raving about the corner of old something-smudged street, some nameless club and a pink neon rabbit with tits and a top hat, individual drivers were going to chortle grimly, ignore the controller, and shelve the fare. There just wasn't enough zone custom to push things the other way. You went to the zones, you drove, or you walked home. He caught eyes, made no attempt to look away. He remembered Mike's demeanor on their previous expeditions to the zones, and aped it. Be who you are, and fuck 'em if they don't like it. The gun helped. No one wanted to push it any farther than a curled lip. No one came close. No one said anything. Outside one of the clubs, two crack whores broke his run of luck. They registered the clothes and stumbled across the road toward him like kids wading into cold water on a shingled beach. Their bare legs worked as if badly jointed. Their feet were wrenched on ludicrous stiletto heels. They wore push-up bras and black mesh microskirts, cinched savagely tight. Their makeup was sweat-streaked and caked, and their eyes looked bruised half-shut. One was skinnier than the other, but otherwise the pre-dawn whore's makeover rendered them uniform, wiped difference away. They were all of 14 years old.
"You want to get sucked?" asked the skinny one. "You got a place to go?"
The other was clearly the brains of the outfit, the forward thinker. Chris shook his head. "Go home."
"Don't be harsh, baby. Just want to do you good."
The skinny girl amplified her sales pitch with a finger-licking display. She stuck the wet finger inside one cup of her barely necessary bra and rubbed it back and forth with a fixed little smile. Chris flinched. "I said go home." He raised the Nemex where they couldn't miss it. "You don't want anything to do with me."
"Baby, that's a big gun you got," said the skinny girl. "You want to put it somewhere warm?"
Chris fled. He came through the westward cordons at Holland Park an hour before dawn. The checkpoint detail gave him some strange looks but said nothing, and once his shorn card swiped clear they called him a cab. He stood outside the cabin while he waited for it to arrive, staring back across the barriers the way he'd come. His mobile queeped. He looked at it, saw it was Carla, and turned it off. The cab arrived. He had the driver take him to work. Chapter 38. This early on a Sunday, the shorn block was in darkness above the mezzanine level, and the shut-down locks were still in place.
He buzzed security, and they let him in without comment or visible surprise. He supposed, rather bitterly, that it couldn't be entirely unheard of for a Shawn exec to come in before dawn on a weekend. He thought briefly about grabbing a few hours' sleep in the hospitality suites, then dismissed the idea out of hand. Outside it was already getting light. He wouldn't sleep unaided now. Instead, he rode the elevator all the way up to the 53rd floor, made his way through the cozy dimness of corridors lit at standby wattage, and let himself into his office. On the desk, the phone was already flashing a message light. He checked it, saw it was from Carla, and wiped it. He stood afterward with his finger on the stud for a while, reached once for the receiver, but never made it. Reached for the lighting control on the data down, but changed his mind. The grey, pre-dawn quiet the office was steeped in had an oddly comforting quality, like a childhood hiding place, like a pillow under his cheek and a clock in front of his face showing a good solid hour before alarm time. Without the lights, he was in limbo, a comfortable state in which decisions did not have to be made, in which you didn't have to move forward any more, the sort of state that just couldn't last. But while it did... He muted the phone's ringtone, went to the built-in cupboards by the door and took out a blanket. Crossing to the sofa and coffee table island in the corner of the office, he shucked his jacket, shoulder holster and shoes, and then lowered himself onto the sofa. Then he covered himself with the blanket, and lay staring at the white, textured ceiling, waiting for the slow creep of morning to soak across it. Back down at reception, the younger of the two security guards made bladder excuses and left his colleague while he went up to the mezzanine. He pushed through the swing doors of the toilets, locked himself in a cubicle, and took out his phone. He hesitated for a moment, then grimaced and punched out a number. The phone purred beside a wide, grey-sheeted bed in a space lit by hooded blue softs. A massive picture window in one wall was polarized to dark. On a table under the sill, a chess set of ornate figurines stood next to a screen that displayed the state of play in silver, black, and blue. Grecian effect sculpture stood around the room on plinths in the shadows. Beneath the sheets, the curves of two bodies moved against each other as the ringing tone penetrated layers of sleep. Louise Hewitt poked her head up, reached for the receiver, and held it to her ear. She glared balefully at the time display beside the phone.
"This had better be fucking important."
She listened to the hastily apologetic voice at the other end, and her eyes opened wide. She twisted, struggled free of the sheet, and propped herself up on one elbow.
"No, you were right to call me. Yes, I did say that. Yes, it is unusual, I agree. Of course. No, I won't forget this. Thank you."
She cradled the receiver and turned over onto her back. Her gaze was dreamy on the blue-tinged ceiling, her tone thoughtful.
"Chris just rolled into work on his own, in a cab, 4:30 on a Sunday morning. Looks like he's been up all night."
The slim form beside her stirred fully awake. Chris was dreaming about the supermarket again. But this time he was watching the whole scene from outside, and the parking lot was insanely, impossibly full of cars. They were everywhere, every colour under the sun, like spilled candy, and all in motion, cruising and parking and reversing out like some immense robotic ballet, and he couldn't get through them. Each time he took a step toward the supermarket and the people in its brilliantly lit interior, a car rolled into his path and stopped with a short squeak of brakes. He had to go around. He had to go around. And his time was running out. The people inside didn't know. They were shopping in anaesthetized warmth and content, and they had no way of knowing what was coming. Up on the roof, tube metal groaned and clanked in protest as the reindeer shook its head. And the cars, he suddenly saw, were all empty. There were no shoppers in them, no one driving, no one loading, no one anywhere. Everybody was inside, shopping, fucking shopping. He made it to the doors and tried to open them, but they were closed up with impact plastic boarding and meters of heavy steel chain. He tried banging on the windows, shouting, but no one heard him. The shots, when they came, rippled the glass under his hands, and as always, they drilled into his ear like something physical. He yelped and woke up, fists clenched under his chin. For a moment, he cringed there, curled defensively at one end of the sofa. He'd twisted the blanket up in his sleep, and now it barely covered half his body. He blinked hard a couple of times, breathed out, and sat up. Dawn had come and gone while he slept, and the office was full of bright sunlight. He got up from the sofa and found his shoes. Bending to put them on, he felt his head throbbing. He'd drowsed himself into a low-grade headache. He shambled to the desk and opened drawers with myopic clumsiness, looking for painkillers. The phone flashed at one corner of his vision. He fumbled a snarl and checked numbers on the piled-up messages. Carla. 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 Fucking Carla. And Liz Linshaw. He stopped dead. The call had come in an hour ago. He grabbed a foil of speed delivery codeine tabs out of an open drawer and hit play.
"Chris, I tried you at home, but your wife didn't know where you were."
A wry curl to the voice. He could see the faint smile that went with it.
She wasn't too helpful, but I got the impression you might be coming into work today. So listen, there's a breakfast bar in India Street called Breakpoint. I'm meeting someone there at 8:30. I think you might want to be there, too.
He checked his watch. 8:20. Jacket. Nemex. He chewed up the codeine tabs on his way down in the lift, swallowed the powder, and went out hurriedly into the sun. It took him a little longer than he expected to find India Street. He remembered the breakfast bar from a damage limitation strategy meeting he'd had there once, when he still worked at Hammett McCall. But because he associated the place with the reinsurance brokers at the meeting, he misremembered the address and found himself in an alley off Fenchurch Street with the wrong name. He cast about for a couple of minutes, blurry with the onset of the codeine, before the mistake dawned on him. Working off the new memory, he plotted a vague eastward course and set out again through the tangle of deserted streets. He was walking north up the glass-walled canyon curve of Crutched Friars when someone yelled his name.
"Faulkner!"
The word echoed off the enclosing steel and glass walls, bounced away down the curve of the canyon. Chris jerked around, sludgily aware he was in trouble. About 20 meters away, blocking his way to the right turn into India Street, five figures stood spread out across the width of the road. All five wore black ski masks. All five hefted weapons that to his untutored eye looked like shotguns. They were faced off against him in the ludicrous cliché stance of a Western gunfight, and despite it all, despite the abrupt knowledge of his own rapidly approaching death, Chris felt a smirk creep out across his face.
"You what?"
Maybe it was the codeine. He laughed out loud, shouted it.
"You fucking what?"
The men facing him shifted, apparently discomforted. They glanced inward to the figure at the center. The man took a step forward. Hands pumped the shotgun's action. The clack-clack echoed along the street.
"Go for it, Faulkner!"
The knowledge hit Chris like cold water. He opened his mouth to yell the name, knew he would be shot before he could get it out.
"Just a minute."
Everyone looked around at the new voice. Mike Bryant stood at the mouth of a side alley about 10 meters behind Chris, panting slightly. He raised his left hand, right floating close to his belt. Gripped in the upraised fist was a thick wad of currency. Makin faltered behind his mask. The shotgun lowered a couple of degrees.
"This has nothing to do with you," he called.
"Oh, but it does."
Mike ambled out of the alley and drifted up the street until he was lined up beside Chris. There was a thin beading of sweat across his brow, and Chris remembered he couldn't be more than a day out of the hospital. He still held the wad of cash before him like a weapon.
"You take down one Sean exec in the street, and where's it going to end, eh, Nick? You're breaking the fucking rules, man."
And out of the corner of his mouth he muttered to Chris, "You carrying?"
"Yeah, I'm carrying."
"Loaded this time?" Chris nodded tautly. A surge of adrenaline punched through the codeine vagueness, a savage pleasure at the comradeship in the man at his side and the will to do harm together.
Good to know. Follow my lead. This is going to go fast.
We only want Faulkner, shouted Macon.
Mike grinned and raised his voice again.
That's too bad, Nick, because you got me, too.
It was the bright, energetic tone Chris had last heard when Bryant crippled and blinded Griff Dixon in his own living room.
And before we start, gentlemen, just look at tonight's wonderful prizes.
He held up the fistful of banknotes again. His voice resonated in the Steel Canyon acoustics, loud and game-show fruity.
For the winners, €20,000 in cash. Lay down your weapons and walk away with it all, tonight. Or take the gamble, lose and die, ladies and gentlemen. You decide.
He hurled the money up and outward. It was bundled together with a thick metallic band that glinted as it turned end over end, high in the bright morning air.
Now, he snapped.
After that, it all seemed to be happening on freeze-frame advance. Chris tugged out the Nemex. It felt appallingly heavy in his hand, appallingly slow to bring around and point. Beside him, Mike Bryant was already firing. Macon's contingent was still staring up at the money. Mike's first slug took the man on Macon's right under his back-tilted chin, tore through his neck and dropped him in a shower of arterial blood. The remaining four scattered across the perspectives of the street. Chris held the Nemex out, memories of 100 shooting gallery hours like iron tracery in his right arm. He squeezed the trigger, felt the kick, squeezed again. One of the men ahead of him staggered, hard to see blood against the dark canvas clothes. He squeezed again, the man folded forward and collapsed on his face in the street. A shotgun boomed. He pointed and fired at Macon, missed. Out of peripheral vision he saw Mike Bryant stalking forward, face fixed in a grin, Nemex extended, shooting in an arc. Another of Macon's men went down, clutching at his thigh. Another shotgun blast. Chris felt a thin stinging of pellets across his ribs. He spotted Macon, pumping another shell in. He yelled and ran toward him, firing wildly. Macon saw him coming and took aim. Another figure stumbled into Macon's path, shooting across the street at Mike. The two men tangled. Chris shot indiscriminately into them both. Macon got clear, raised the shotgun again. There seemed to be something wrong with his arm. Chris emptied the Nemex into him. The gun locked back, breech open on the last shot. And it was over. The echoes rolled away, like trucks moving off down the street. Chris stood over Nick Macon and watched as he stopped breathing. Off to his left, Mike Bryant walked up to the shotgunner he'd hit in the thigh. The injured man flopped about, weakly. Blood was leaking in astonishing quantities from his twisted leg. Beneath the mask, his head shifted back and forth between Chris and Mike like a trapped animal's. He was making a panicked, moaning noise.
"Look, you're going to bleed to death anyway," Mike told him.
The Nemex shell punched him flat. The ski-masked head jerked about with the impact. A new rivulet of blood groped out across the asphalt from the torn wool and gore of the exit wound. Mike knelt and checked his handiwork, then looked up at Chris and grinned.
5-2, eh? Not bad for a couple of suits.
Chris shook his head numbly. The Nemex hung at the end of his arm like a dumbbell weight. He unlocked the open breech, put the weapon away, fumbling with the holster, post-drive shakes setting in.
This is nice.
Mike picked up the dead man's shotgun and hefted it with approval.
Remington tactical pump. Fancy a souvenir?
Chris said nothing. Bryant got up, tucked the shotgun casually under his arm.
It's okay. I'll talk to the police, get one for both of us out of evidence when they've finished with it. Something to show your grandchildren.
He shook his head, talking a little fast with the adrenaline crash.
Fucking unbelievable, eh? Like something off a game platform. Ah, so you got Macon pretty good then?
Yeah. Chris looked incuriously at where the other exec lay, still masked. Up close you could see the wounds in his chest and belly. His whole body was drenched with the blood. Dead. Mike looked around judiciously.
I think they all are.
Oh, wait a minute.
He crossed to the man Chris had hit when he tangled with Macon. He crouched and put two fingers to the man's neck, shrugged. On his way out, I reckon. Still. He got up and pointed the Nemex down at the man's masked face. He was already turning away as he pulled the trigger.
How did you know I'd be here? Chris asked him.
Another shrug.
Carla called me this morning at home, in tears. Told me you'd had a fight. You'd gotten out in the middle of the zones, and now she couldn't get hold of you. I came in looking for you. Had to break into your office. Sorry about that. I was pretty worried. Anyway, I spotted that message from Liz, thought I'd catch you up. Took a while. My ribs are still killing me.
Chris looked at him narrowly. You just happened to be carrying 20 grand in cash.
Oh, that.
Mike grinned again and crossed to where the bundle of currency still lay on the street.
Improvisation. Look.
He tossed the money across and Chris caught it awkwardly with his left hand. The notes were 20s. There were 1,000 euros in the bundle at most.
Best I could do on the spur of the moment.
You really walk in from the zones last night?
Yeah. Must have been some fight.
They stood amid the carnage, the scattered weapons and spreading pools of blood, and very slowly Chris became aware that, among a small knot of people gathered at the end of India Street, Liz Linshaw was watching him. He walked toward her.
Do you have any idea how bad this looks?
Louise Hewitt stood stiff-legged at the head of the conference table and gestured at the projection. Blown-up surveillance camera footage ran grainy and silent behind her, Mike Bryant giving the coup de grace to the two masked gunmen still breathing.
Do you have any idea what this kind of brawling does to our image as a serious financial institution?
Chris shrugged. His side was numb where the shorn medic had dosed him with contact anesthetic prior to digging out the shotgun pellets. The rest of him was past feeling very much of anything, either.
You should be talking to Macon. He started it.
This is not a fucking playground, Faulkner.
Louise, you're being unreasonable.
Mike Bryant met Philip Hamilton's eyes across the table, and the other man looked away, toward Hewitt. Beside him, Jack Notley stared into the middle distance, seemingly oblivious to the storm building around him.
Macon called this one, all the way down. If I hadn't been there, Chris would be dead now, and the blame would be farmed out to zone gangwits. We wouldn't even know we had a loose cannon aboard.
On the projection screen, Chris walked away from the bodies and out of shot. It was odd, watching himself disappear, back into the past of 3 hours ago and the confrontation with Liz Linshaw. You set me up. She took it like a slap. For the first time he could recall, he saw open hurt in her face. The sight of it licked the pit of his belly.
You fucking set me up, you bitch.
No, she was shaking her head. Chris, I don't... And then Mike was there, and they both slid their masks back on, passion sheathed. There was control. There were words that meant something factual. There was the long verbal come-down. Explanations, talk, and shots of rough blended whiskey in breakpoint to combat the shakes, sanity leaking into the nightmare aftermath like blood across asphalt. I just got a call. This guy said he worked driver control. He knew what really happened to Chris on the M11. Did I want to know, too? Meet him here, 5 grand in cash. She brandished the money out of her wallet, like proof of innocence. When Mike went to the bathroom, she reached out across the cheap, plastic-topped table and took Chris's hand in her own. No words. Only a cabled look, eye to eye. Spinning sudden vertigo, and then the flush of the toilet through cardboard-thin walls, and their hands leapt apart like matched magnetic poles. Louise Hewitt was talking to him, but he couldn't make it matter. He levered himself to his feet, faced her disbelieving fury.
I've had enough of this shit, Louise. It's pretty fucking clear what happened here.
Sit down, Faulkner. I haven't...
Macon couldn't hack the name account. I took it from him, and it hurt. He couldn't take me on the road, so he hired a gangwit kid to do what he didn't dare do himself. When that didn't work...
I told you to sit down.
he shouted her down. When that didn't fucking work, Louise, he hired some more sicarios and tried this. He couldn't beat me playing by the Sean rules, so he broke them, and now he's dead. Everybody in fucking black.
Chris!
Notley's voice didn't seem to have raised much, but there was an edge on it that cut across the air like tire screech.
You don't talk to partnership like this. You're overwrought, but that's no excuse. Now get out.
Chris met the senior partner's eyes and saw the man who had almost shot him dead in his own office a week ago. He nodded.
Fair enough.
They watched him go in silence. Mike Bryant looked around the table again. He shook his head.
This isn't right, Jack. I mean, it's a fucking mess, but Makin called it. He's been a fuck-up since he took over the name. He was way too impressed with himself from day one. I would have called him out myself, but what's the point? Anyone could have seen he'd blink first.
Hamilton blinked. I beg your pardon?
You don't have to drive against someone to know you're better than he is, Phil. That's crude. Sometimes you just know what the outcome would be, and that's enough. This kill-or-be-killed shit just gets in the way.
The look ran among the partners like current. Up on the projector screen, the surveillance film had looped. The gun battle was starting again. Jack Notley cleared his throat.
Mike, perhaps you could give us some time to discuss this from a partner perspective. We'll get back to you again on Monday morning.
Bryant nodded.
Sure.
When the door closed, Louise Hewitt spun on Notley.
Did you hear that? You know where that comes from, don't you? That's chess and bullshit neo-Jap philosophy, courtesy of Chris Bloody Faulkner. The man is a fucking toxin, Jack. He's the real loose cannon around here.
It doesn't show up like that in the numbers, Louise.
It's not about the numbers.
No?
Notley raised an eyebrow.
Am I missing something here? Would you care to tell me what Sean C.I. is about, besides the numbers?
Don't be obtuse. It's about an ethic, a corporate culture, a way of doing things, and if we let that go, this...
She jabbed a finger at the surveillance film. Masked figures, collapsed like unstrung marionettes, pools and snakes of blood.
Is what happens. Structural breakdown, anarchy in the streets. It's axiomatic. Does anyone sitting around this table have any inkling why Nick Makin might have acted the way he did? Why he found it necessary? Even believed, perhaps, that it would be acceptable to breach Sean etiquette like this? Think hard, Jack. Think about a certain major client beaten to death in conference a week ago. Think about the way you rewarded Faulkner for that. Does anyone see a connection?
For a fraction of a second, Notley closed his eyes. When he spoke, there was a soft warning in his voice.
I don't think we need to revisit that, Louise.
I think we do, Jack. You gave Chris a green light for behavior beyond any acceptable limits, and Makin learned the lesson, resulting in this mess. And meanwhile, we've got Bryant, our best driver, talking like a fucking ombudsman. Any way you look at it, Jack, you've destabilized what we're about, and we can't afford that.
I wonder if Martin Page would see it that way.
Hamilton and Hewitt traded a glance. Hewitt came to the table and seated herself carefully.
Is that some kind of accusation?
Notley shrugged.
Let's just say that your talk of loose cannons is selective, Louise. Page was a junior partner. What you did to him ran counter at least to an unspoken understanding of how partnership works here.
I resent that, Jack. Page was a filed challenge.
Yes, a challenge without a vacant post to justify it. Executive brawling at partnership level, an act of pure equity share greed.
Which you underwrote, as I recall.
Retrospectively, yes. Because back then, Louise, you were the loose cannon, and I admired you for it.
Hewitt smiled thinly.
Well, thank you. But I think there's a limit.
Oh, shut up. Don't talk to me about...
Notley gestured impatiently.
Destabilization. As if it's something we have some kind of choice about. As if it's something we can avoid. What we do here is built on instability. It's a fucking prerequisite.
Philip Hamilton cleared his throat. I think what Louise means is...
Yes, I thought it was about time you weighed in, you little sycophant. Christ, you're beginning to sicken me, both of you.
Motley stood up and strode to the head of the table. He stabbed the projector control with two folded fingers, and the wall behind him was abruptly blank. His voice was tight with leashed anger.
"Louise, I helped you climb to the top of this pile, and now you're up here. All you want to do is surround yourself with low-threat colleagues like this bag of guts, and kick away the ladder in case anybody sharper gets to scramble up and destabilize things for you. Haven't you learned anything on the way up, either of you? You can't have stability and dynamic capital growth. It's textbook truth. Come on. What transformed the stock market back in the last century? Volatility, competition, deregulation, the loosening of the ties, the removal of social security systems. What's transformed foreign investment in the last 30 years? Volatility, competition. Small wars. It's the same pattern. And what ensures that we stay on top of it all? Volatility, innovation, rule-breaking, loose cannons. Christ, why do you think I hired Faulkner in the first place? We need that factor. We have to keep topping up with it, otherwise we all just turn back into the same fat fuck complacent country club scum that nearly sank us last time around. Sure, men like Faulkner are unstable. Sure, they keep you looking in your rear view all the time, but that's what keeps us hard.
For a couple of beats, silence held the conference room. Nobody moved. Notley stared from Hewitt to Hamilton and back, daring them to dispute. Finally, Hewitt shook her head.
"It may make you hard, Jack," she said with measured insolence, "but to me it's just bad business. We have structures in place to ensure volatility and competition. I don't think we need to go courting chaos into the bargain. I'm making a recommendation this quarterly that we let Faulkner go."
Notley nodded, almost affably.
"All right, Louise, if that's the way you want it. But understand this. We've been courting chaos since the day we signed on for conflict investment. All of us. It's what drives us. It's what gets results. And I'm not going to watch you sell that out just because you've gotten comfortable. You go on record with that recommendation, I will find reasons to call you out. Do you understand me? I will drive you off the road."
This time no one broke the silence. Notley leaned his neck hard to one side, and they heard it click in the stillness.
"That will be all."
When he had gone, Hewitt got up and went to stare out the window. Hamilton pushed out a long breath.
"Do you think he means it?"
"Of course he means it," Hewitt said irritably.
"So what are you going to do?"
"I don't know."
She came back to sit on the edge of the table. She looked down into Hamilton's face.
"But I'm going to need your help."
Chapter 39. Out in the corridor, Mike Bryant quizzed security. They told him Chris had taken an elevator to the ground floor. "Seemed pretty pissed off," admitted one of the guards. Mike called an elevator of his own and bombed downward in pursuit. He spotted Chris already halfway across the sunlit cathedral expanse of the lobby. The hollows and fountains and subsonics were all switched off, and there was nobody about. In the Sunday afternoon emptiness that was left, the space felt suddenly steely and inhuman. Mike cleared his throat and called across it.
"Chris! Hey, Chris! Wait up a minute."
"Now's not a good time, Mike."
Chris flung it back over his shoulder, not stopping.
"Okay."
Mike jogged to catch up. Residual bruising across his chest made it painful.
"You're right. It's not a good time. So why don't we go and grab a drink somewhere?"
"I've got to get my car back from Hawkesburg Green, and then check into a hotel."
"You're not going home."
"What do you think?" Mike put out a hand, breathing heavily.
"What I think is, you need to drink some of that seaweed iodine shit you'd like and talk about this. And luckily, I'm here to listen to you spill, all right? Come on. I saved your life out there, Chris. At least buy me a drink, all right?"
Chris looked at him. An unwilling smile bent his mouth. Mike saw it and grinned back.
"All right. I'll get the car."
They found a tiny antique pub called The Grapes, tacked onto the Lime Street edge of Leadenhall Market, catering mainly to the insurance crowd and powered down to a single barwoman for the Sunday trade. Like most city-based hostelries,
It opened 7 days a week because the simple fact that it was always open was worth something in itself. Brokers knew they could get fed and watered there whatever day they were working, and the knowledge stuck. There was no room for 5-day amateurs. 3 or 4 whiskies in, Chris had drowned his fury and was slumped on a stool, watching dust motes dance in the streams of sunlight that fell in through the windows opposite the bar. A faint, pervasive odor of alcohol seeped up off the polished wood counter. The Lafrague sat on top of the cheap 3 fingers he'd taken in break point, the codeine tabs, and no food to speak of. He felt like a mud-smeared windshield.
"Look," Mike was saying, "it doesn't matter what Hewitt thinks. You took Macon down. That's what counts. Sure, it was unorthodox, but that's the point, isn't it? It ups your don't-fuck-with-me stock through the roof, builds you the killer rep."
Killer rep. Chris stared into his glass. He coughed up a laugh and shook his head. "You want to know something about me, Mike?"
"Sure."
"My killer rep is a fucking accident." He saw how the other man's gaze narrowed. He nodded, knocked back the rest of the Lafrague, grunted, like letting go.
"That's right. I'm a fucking fake, Mike. Hewitt has me crosshairs and centred. She always did. She's not wrong. I don't belong here."
Mike frowned, finished his vodka, and gestured to the barwoman.
"Same again."
"Chris, what are you talking about?
You've been a fuel-injected killing machine since Quain, at least."
"Ah, Quain." Chris watched as the whiskey rose 2 fingers in his glass. "Quain, Quain, Quain. You want to know about Quain?"
"I already know about Quain. Chris, you left him smeared along 30 meters of asphalt. That's pretty open and shut. You ran him over 5 fucking times, man."
"Yeah." He sat, remembering. Brilliant spring sunshine, and the crunching impact of his barely legal 10-year-old Volvo injection against the smooth racing green flanks of Quain's Audi. The light had gleamed so hard off the bodywork he'd had to squint. And Quain, spinning out, finally into the barrier, jammed onto a snapped section of uprights, what Chris had been trying for all through the difficult latter stages of the duel, well past the point when he'd actually won. Quain, gaping, middle-aged and fearful through the smashed-in driver's side window, as the Volvo backed up, preliminary to ramming, gaping as Chris killed the motor and got out. He felt his face twitch with the memory. He seemed to make the walk between the 2 cars at an immense distance from himself. The turnover of his pulse throbbed in his own ears. No Nemexes back then. He walked right up to the window and showed Quain the thing in his hand. The recycled raki bottle. The soaked rag. Perfume of gasoline as he waved it back and forth. Snap of the lighter and the pale flame in the sunny air. Quain started babbling. "Get out," Chris told him, surprising himself. The plan had been to burn Quain alive. The plan had been to tell Quain why, and then throw the bottle with enough force to shatter on the floor between his feet. The plan had been to watch Quain turned into a shrieking, flailing, flame-armed thing, to listen to the screams and... "Get out and run, you fuck." And Quain did. Crazed, maybe, with fear of what he saw in Chris's eyes, hypnotized by the blob of pale, dancing flame, Chris stood there and watched him go, groping about inside his own head for a reason. Something was happening in there, and he couldn't make out what it was. He threw the bottle into the Audi anyway, as much in frustration as anything else. It shattered on the dash and the flames sprang up. The sight seemed to switch something back on inside him. He sprinted back to the Volvo, kicked it alive and floored the accelerator. Fishtail waltz as he hauled the wheel over and his gaze sharpened on the portly, lumbering figure ahead on the road. Quain must have heard the engine and known what it meant. He was making for the median as the Volvo came up on his heels. It wouldn't have made any difference, Chris realized later. He would have driven straight through it to get to Quain. He dropped a gear and the engine screamed. Quain looked back over his shoulder just before the Volvo hit. Chris saw his eyes. Then he was gone, a suddenly impossibly aerodynamic body thudding and tumbling up off the hood, the windshield, the roof. A flash of dark falling in the rear view as Chris braked the Volvo to a screeching halt. It wasn't enough. He never knew if Quain was dead when he reversed back over him the first time, but he saw what emerged under the front wheels as he pulled up 5 meters back from the body. It still wasn't enough. He did it again, and again. 5 times, before he realized it would never be enough. "He killed my father," he said. And Mike Bryant, staring at him in the sifting dust light, a look on his face Chris had never seen before, stalled out, lost. "Your father." Chris sighed, loading up for the long, tedious climb of explanation. "Not directly. Quain never met my father directly. My father worked for a reconstruction consultancy called IES, International Economic Solutions, but when you said it all together it sounded like yes. Cute, huh? My mother said he used to." He clamped his mouth, shook his head, cleared his throat. They modelled admin systems, infrastructure, things like that. They were into Central Africa, the Middle East. Pretty small, but hungry and hard on the roads as far as that went back then." Mike nodded. "Enough just to get there first, right?" "That's what they say." Chris stared at a ray of dusty light falling across the bar top. A faint scarring of overlaid glass rings showed up in the wooden glow. "In 2018, Edward Quain was a hot-shot young gun in Hammett McCall emerging markets. Couldn't have been older than his early 20s. And he pulled off this cutting-edge piece of incursion for Hammett McCall in Ethiopia. Got backing for a major policy shift. Nothing dramatic by CI standards. This is more than 30 years ago, remember? But it was enough to bring down the government. A lot of high-ranking officials lost their jobs, and Quain's new team publicly reneged on a stack of external contracts. Happened overnight, literally. IES couldn't take the damage. They went under, bankrupted along with a dozen or so others, and about 40% of the low-end commercial sector in Ethiopia at the time. They say it precipitated the civil war." "Oh, yeah, I remember this." Mike snapped his fingers. "The Ayele Protocol, right? Read about it in Reed and Mason." "Right." Quain walked away with a huge commission, Hammett McCall repositioned for regional dominance in the Red Sea zone, and my father woke up with a wallet full of dead plastic he didn't know about. He got shot the same day, arguing with a supermarket security guard. His card wouldn't scan at the checkout. They wouldn't take him seriously. And it got—" Chris watched his knuckles whiten around the whiskey glass with absent fascination, as if they belonged to someone else. "Out of hand. My mother said, if he'd been dressed better that day, it would never have happened. Hated suits, apparently, my old man. Dressed scruffy as he could outside the office. Maybe they thought he'd stolen the card or something. They tried to throw him out. It got rough. Blam. Some fat, over-the-hill fuck with a dick extension blew his fucking head off." He looked at the whiskey glass, let go of it abruptly, and stared at the palm of his suddenly liberated hand. "We lost everything. The house, both cars, health insurance, savings, stock options. My mother got rehoused in the eastern zones. My father's friends helped out as much as they could, but most of them were going under, too. They were all at IES or working in related firms." Chris picked up his drink again, knocked it back. "And then, even that early, they say you could see the domino coming if you were paying attention. It was still nearly a decade off, the worst of it. But people were already running scared, just hanging on with whatever they had. And Quain had just seen to it that we had nothing." "You remember all this?" "Not really, no. I was 2 when my father was killed. I was there, but—" Chris shivered, dodging the dream. "I don't remember it. I just remember growing up in the zones with this accent everybody hated. This vague sense that things were better once, before. But I could have picked that up listening to my mother. No way you remember stuff from when you're 2 years old."
"No, but—"
Mike gestured helplessly. "How the fuck did you—"
"I mean, Quain. Didn't he see you coming?
The day you joined H.M.? How did you even get into H.M., come to that?
I changed my name. My father wasn't called Faulkner. It was my mother's maiden name. She died of thorn fever when I was 17. I took her name, sold everything else we owned, and cut myself a new identity. Got a gangwit data rat in Plasto to fix my records. Probably did a shit job, the money I gave him, but it was what I could afford. I doubt it would have stood up to close scrutiny, but when you're from the zones, who the fuck cares? It was just cheap, faceless labour. And by the time I got to Hammett McCall, I had 5 years of new identity behind me. I'd made a lot of money for Ross Mobile and LS Euro. I could drive. That's all the HM recruiters cared about.
Sloppy. Was that their own people?
No, contracted out. Some cut-rate two-room outfit off Ludgate Circus. They tendered for HM on straight cost. No dual requirement. Lowest offer wins.
Mike shook his head.
Fucking amateurs.
Yeah, but you know what? It wouldn't have mattered anyway. Quain wouldn't have recognized my father's name. Some guy he ruined 20 years ago. One name out of hundreds he probably didn't even know back when it happened, let alone 2 decades later. What are the chances?
Yeah, figures.
Mike puffed out his cheeks.
Jesus, what a story. Does Carla know all this?
No. She knows I grew up in the zones. She knows my parents are dead, but we don't talk about it. I met her after Quain. I'd already buried it all. She used to ask, back when we started seeing each other. Think it might even have been some of the attraction for her, the zone connection. I told her I wasn't interested in looking back. He stared down the receding perspectives of the memory. Snapped her head off whenever she asked. She stopped asking after a while.
Yeah, it's true. You never talk about it, do you?
Chris shrugged.
Nor do you. Nor do any of us. We're all too flat-out fucking busy trying to make it big right now to talk about the past. You'd think none of us had parents the way we live.
Hey, I got parents. I see them pretty often.
Good for you.
Mike shook his head again, a little blearily this time.
Still can't believe it, man. It's like a fucking movie. All the way back from the zones to take down Edward Quain.
Chris finished his drink.
Yeah, well, some of us have what it takes. Some of us don't. Remember?
Oh, shit, Chris, I didn't mean you. I'm not saying everyone in the zones deserves to be there, you know that. If I'd known, you know, about your parents and stuff, I wouldn't have said...
No?
You must have known my background, Mike.
You said yourself that first day I met you in the washroom. Hewitt was batting my details about before I arrived. And it's not a secret where I grew up. It's on the resume.
What?
Mike squinted at him.
Well, yeah, but I assumed... I don't know. Accidental son of some slumming exec and a bar girl, a dancer, something.
Thanks.
Fuck, I don't mean...
I mean,
it doesn't mean anything, but I just assumed. It happens, you know. Seen it happen. Come close a couple of times myself. I just figured something like that. That's how you got your break at Ross Mobile, maybe a leg up into LS as well.
No.
Chris smiled tightly. I got Ross through an old friend of my father. Everything else I clawed down myself.
Don't worry about it, Mike. You were right.
Some of us have what it takes. And what it takes is hate. I had enough hate to paint a tower block. I grew up hating. It was like fuel, like food. You don't need much of anything else when you've got hate.
Look.
And then one morning I woke up and I'd killed Edward Quain, and the world was still there. I had a job. I had a life. Well, a lifestyle, anyway. Hammett McCall had just promoted me. I had money. A lot of money for the first time in my life. He tipped his empty glass horizontal, looked into it and laughed. It seemed a little ungracious not to go on living. The two of them sat there in silence for a while. Finally, Mike shifted uncomfortably and cleared his throat.
Chris.
He hesitated.
You want to stay at my place tonight?
No. Thanks, no. I've got to be alone for a while, Mike. There's stuff I need to sort out. I'll get a hotel. But thanks. And...
he waved vaguely.
Thanks for, you know, saving my life and everything.
Bryant grinned.
Shit. I always owed you for Mitsui Jones. Just call it even.
The hotel would not hold him. He poured himself a whiskey, another fucking whiskey, and stared at the phone as if it were poisonous. His mobile was still switched off. No one, outside of Mike, knew where he was. He'd have to pick up and dial. He picked up the TV remote instead and zapped through the channels. Endless, mindless, brightly colored shit, and an upbeat report just in from Cambodia. He recognized the editing. He shut down the TV's painted window and went out on the balcony. Warm night air gusted over his face. A well-lit Kensington Street angled past 7 floors below. A couple walked along it, arm in arm. Laughter floated up. A cab idled by in the opposite direction, cruising for custom. He retreated to the bedroom. He lay face up on the bed and stared at the perfectly molded plaster ceiling. Tension itched down his limbs. He prowled the suite and gnawed a thumbnail down to the quick. He hit the laptop and tried to carry out simple database tasks. He hurled the whiskey glass across the room. He grabbed wallet, Nemex, jacket, and he left. She was waiting for him. She must have heard the cab in the street outside. The door opened as he pressed the bell. She stood in the clothes she'd worn at breakpoint. Black leggings and a loose grey running top, face scrubbed clean of makeup, hair gathered back. They stood looking at each other, an arm's reach apart. "I've got to talk to you," he started. But she shook her head. She reached for him as he crossed the threshold. It felt like falling. He was close enough to smell freshly drunk coffee on her breath. Behind that, the swirl of female scent mingled with orange blossom. The kiss was an open-mouthed collision that squeezed tears into his eyes, a mutual assault of tongues, of teeth tugging on lips and hands on clothing below. She was laughing excitedly into his open mouth as they clinched, and his hands felt impossibly full of her body, unable to grasp the substance of it with enough force. He kicked the door shut and found a breast beneath the sports top, unsupported and surgically perfect. The porn segment sprang through his mind like sweat. Hard under soft, a swathe of stomach sprung with taut muscle, the hard length of one thigh and the lift of ass-cheek above it. He could not settle on any of it. Her leg thrust between his and ground upward against his prick. He was already hard. She bit him on the neck. Hands dragged him down the hall, past the kitchen and bathroom, and left into an untidy bedroom. Cluttered bedside unit, a teetering pile of books, and a glass of stale water, a pale blue quilt crumpled across an unmade bed. He drank it in, and the new intimacy was a tiny itching in the pit of his stomach, an opening to an inner sanctum built into his prior knowledge of the rest of the house. She let him go with a sudden motion, as if he were hot, sank to the bed in front of him, and peeled off her leggings in 2 single stripping motions. Fingers touched the mound beneath the white cotton thong she wore underneath, rubbing the groove up and down. She grinned up at him as she did it. Her free hand scrabbled across to the bedside table, ripped open a drawer, and reached inside. "No, wait." He shed jacket and shirt, dropped to his knees beside the bed, and buried his face in the white cotton, breathing in the undiluted scent of her. She gasped and sank back on the folds of the quilt. The heated heart of flesh between her thighs was moist. He slid his hands up the insides of her thighs, fingers first, pulled aside the cotton, and sank his tongue into her. A hard spasm, and her hands came to grip the sides of his head. Her legs lifted and folded over his back like wings. She was panting. When she came, she ground up hard against him with a deep grunting sound, then flopped to twitching stillness. He shouldered his way gently out from under her legs and straightened up. In the drawer she had opened, he found the Durex can. He rolled its chilly length along the plane of her stomach. Got another twitch as it touched her, then lodged it between her breasts and rolled it idly back and forth in the indelible cleavage surgery had given her. She raised herself on her elbows.
"So, what do you want now?" she asked, mock tough.
I want to fuck you, Liz. She seemed to consider that for a moment, head tilted slightly. Then she sat up, tugged her hair loose of its binding, and set about unfastening his belt buckle. She liberated the engorged length of his prick from the cloth it was trapped in, handling it with greedy care and sliding it back and forth into her mouth. Then she gripped it at base between thumb and forefinger, picked up the Durex can, and sprayed him steadily, from end to end. It was a long time since he'd needed to use the stuff, and the sudden, cold tightening of the instant membrane was a shock. He gasped, and Liz Linshaw grinned again as she heard it.
"That's just for starters," she said in the back of her throat, and held up the can for his inspection. "This is cocktail-laced. Expensive stuff. You wait till the contact sensitizers kick in. You're not going to last long."
He reached for her, and she scooted back on the bed, opening herself for him. He sank all the way into her with a groan, cupped one breast in both hands, working the flesh. He sucked in the nipple, and it touched the roof of his mouth. She was right. He didn't last long.
"Can you feel my heart?" she asked him later.
He nodded drowsily against her chest.
"It's still beating like a fucking drum, Chris. That's with thinking about what you did to me. I want you to do it again."
"What?
Right now?"
She laughed.
"Well, ideally, yeah, but I can wait."
She craned her neck to look at his face.
"Are you staying the night?"
"If you ask me to."
"Stay the night."
"No, I gotta go."
"You bastard," she slapped at his flank. "That's not funny. I want you to stay, Chris. I want access to you."
"You've got access to me. Look at me." But beneath the comfortable humor, he felt a vague stirring of alarm. Not at what she wanted, at what he might want from her.
"So we're going to do this again?"
He thought about Carla, pushed the thought away again. Let go. "Yeah, we are. I'm living out of a hotel now, Liz. No more complications." And in the back of his head, something heard and lifted its throat to the sky and laughed like a hyena. Amid the plinthed Grecian sculpture, Louise Hewitt sat on the edge of the grey-sheeted bed and stared past the white blast of a bedside halogen lamp. The room was silent around her. She had hung her jacket away with automated care on her way into the apartment, and now her shoulders slumped under the soft silk of her blouse. There was an unaccustomed ache in her throat. She looked down at the bed and pressed her lips together. Then she lay sideways on the covers and lowered her face to the pillow. His scent came off the grey cotton, and she clenched her eyes shut.
"Oh, Christ, Nick,"
she murmured, and her throat clicked as she swallowed.
"Didn't I tell you? Didn't I warn you?"
She lay there for a while, and a single tear leaked out from under her right eyelid. It trickled jerkily to the edge of her face and soaked into the pillow. When the second and third tear slipped out, she sat up abruptly and wiped them off her face with the angry gesture of someone ripping off a mask. She cleared her throat, got up from the bed, and went through to the study. She stabbed the data down awake and seated herself before its soft, multicolored glow. She worked. File number 5. Final Audit. Chapter 40. There were times over the next few weeks when Chris had to forcibly remind himself that this was his own life he was leading. Partly it was the hotel. There was something insulated about living out of a box of high-class services long-term, something that felt like wearing thin rubber gloves. Household tasks he was used to performing himself happened distantly, almost invisibly. He put out his dirty laundry, and it came back again pristine, as if cleaned by elves. Fresh towels and little bottles of soap and shampoo appeared daily in the bathroom by a similar magic. He ordered food, and it came to his door from a kitchen he never saw, or he fed himself in one of the hotel's 3 internal restaurants. Either way, he was saved the tiny increments of physical and emotional effort involved in going outside to look for a place to eat. At Shawn, He performed with a slightly numb, mechanical competence. The work piled up into account overload as Nick Makin's abrupt departure took its toll on everyone. He cut a path through it like someone working through dense bush with a blunt machete. Focus ahead, swing, grab, clear, and step. Focus ahead, swing. Occasionally he sagged, but habit kept him on his feet. The pellet wounds in his side healed, fading rapidly from actual pain to inconvenience to vague memory. Dreams of Carla stubbornly refused to follow the same path. Covert reports came in from the name via Lopez. Branko had taken his first dose of Shawn Beneficence, 300 Kalashnikovs plus ammunition, 30 of the Aerospatial plane killers, and even 1,000 King grenades, all brought ashore in the dead of night on some Pacific beach, courtesy of a privatized Epsilon-class Russian attack sub and her demobbed crew. The best international bulk-by-stealth couriers money could buy. On the other side of the globe, Nakamura played Cambodia the way Vasvik had told him they would, planning for the military coup lurched into motion. Chris had the relevant local tools at hand. He'd mustered them almost absently, days before the INDESP intelligence came through. He pretended to study the reports, phoned through prearranged authorization codes to Langley an hour later, sat and waited. Explosions bloomed across Phnom Penh like a rash, a colonel and his family in a car bomb, a general in a restaurant, an Air Force commander in a whorehouse, shot three times with an uncharacteristic precision that made Chris suspect the place was a protected Langley franchise of some sort. A couple of others, drive-by and car bomb respectively. The remainder got the message. The coup fell apart before it could properly gain momentum, and Nakamura recoiled. Word came down to Chris from on high. Notley was impressed. Meanwhile, an ongoing investigation was launched into the mysterious disappearance of Nicholas Makin. No one, outside the Shawn debriefing, knew where he'd gone. His corpse was helicoptered out of Crutched Friars with the rest, still masked, still warm, no footage of faces and no DNA trace. Before they left, the rapid response crew Mike called had hosed down the bloody asphalt with chemicals that would defeat any tissue analysis. The firefight was written off as an overly ambitious gang-wit incursion that had met with poetic justice. Carefully massaged media speculation arose that Makin had fallen solitary victim to the same gang before their luck ran out. Chris and Mike gave prepared statements and watched it all from the sidelines. The media did their job, rather better than anyone had expected. Accurate detail dissolved rapidly in a splash of lurid full color, replayed from the surveillance cameras in Crutched Friars. The gunfighter chic of the thing caught and sold. Comp drivers in Eastwood-style bloodbath. Zone gangs reap high noon whirlwind. Police commend Shawn heroes. Coverage went global. TV and the men's magazines went crazy. Chris and Mike got their souvenir Remingtons, handed over by the chief of corporate police in a white gale of erupting flashbulbs. Everyone grinning into the teeth of the media storm. It made the triumph against Mitsua Jones and her team seem like relative obscurity. One morning Mike came into work and found a call on his phone from a Hollywood agent. Studios, the agent said, were lining up. Options, offers, amounts of money that made even Louise Hewitt blink. There was talk of a book tie-in, a game, action figures. "Sign nothing," said Notley, with characteristic avuncular tolerance. "Yet." Corporate police units went into the zones looking for associates and relatives of the four men who had died with Makin. They kicked in doors and broke heads, bullied and bribed, and ascertained that no one knew anything worth telling. Arrests were made. The media stood up on their hind legs and applauded. "Shawn Lee's gang crackdown. Law and order priority for corporate community. Drug scum will be stopped," says Shawn partner. "Safer streets for our kids," promise executives. 10 days in, the original events surrounding Nick Makin's death were gone. No one remembered anything but the quick-draw images of Chris Faulkner and Mike Bryant, outnumbered and outgunned, taking down 5 cold-blooded, cowardly, drug-dealing, masked killers. Reality blurred out in hype. Chris gave interviews, looked into cameras, fended off a spate of calls from the driving fan world and the London Chamber of Commerce. Requests for after-dinner speaker engagements, pleas for worn pieces of the Saab's engine, and offers of bizarre sexual services all fogged into a single drag on his attention. Messages piled up once more on the data down, from the same wolfish-looking women with Eastern European names, and from drive sites like Road Rash and Asphalt Extreme. He read movie treatments and CI reports, with a dazed sense that sometime soon he might not be able to tell the difference. He rolled out the official Sean line, dictated policy down phones. He handled Cambodia, the name, Paraná, Assam, Makin's accounts in Guatemala, Kashmir, Yemen, more. He took the Remington down to the firing range and took out some of the secreted stress on hollow targets. There was a deep satisfaction to the scattered blast pattern it made that not even a Nemex could equal. He grew to like the weapon in a way he had never allowed himself with a pistol. He used the feeling like a drug. In the evenings, in the anonymous seclusion of the hotel, he had Liz Linshaw like a jagged sensory overload on the screen of his feelings. Sprawled elegantly naked across his bed, soaped slick in his shower, pressed against the walls of the room, legs wrapped around, tensed with orgasm, damp with sweat, grinning through her tousled hair. Her, too, he used like a drug, like a materialized visitation from some soft-porn pay-channel reality the hotel had moored close to. When she wasn't there, about every third night, just so we stay sane about this, Chris, he masturbated thinking of her. She helped him sleep, helped him avoid overly conscious introspection when at the ragged end of each day he arrived back in the hotel and found himself wondering if you really could live out a whole life this way. Eventually, Carla came to the hotel. She called first, several times. He had screened her out of his mobile and the office phone, but somehow she'd gotten the hotel out of Mike. The first time she called, he walked into it head-on. He hung at the end of the phone, weightless, making monosyllabic responses. After a while, she cried. He hung up on her. He rang the switchboard and got them to screen and announce all further incoming calls. Then he called Mike, furious. He got an apology of sorts, but what the other man was really thinking came through underneath, loud and clear. "Yeah, I know, Chris. I'm really sorry. She's been calling for days. I just couldn't blow her off any more. She was upset, you know. Really upset." "I'm fucking upset as well, Mike. And I could use a bit of solidarity here. It's not like I go telling tales to Suki behind your back, is it?"
"You need to talk to her, man."
"That's an opinion, Mike, and you're entitled to it. But you don't fucking make my marital decisions for me, got it?" There was a long pause at the other end.
"Got it," Mike said finally.
"Good." Chris cleared his throat, cranked down his tone a little. "I'll see you tomorrow at 8, then. Cambodia briefing."
"Yeah."
"Night, then."
"Yeah."
"Good night, Chris." There was a flat quality in Mike's voice that Chris didn't much like, but he was still too angry himself to care much either. Liz emerged from the bathroom, naked, toweling her hair vigorously.
"Who is that?"
He gestured.
"Ah, Mike. Work stuff."
"Yeah? You look pretty pissed off about it."